You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures entitled Balance in Education. This is Lecture 2, entitled The Three Fundamental Forces in Education, given in Stuttgart on September 16, 1920. It is naturally not possible to educate or give instruction without a kind of inward experiencing of the whole human being. For during children's development, this whole human being needs to be considered far more carefully than later on. As we know, the whole human being comprises within itself the ego, the astral body, the etheric body, and the physical body. These four members of our nature by no means undergo a uniform development. They unfold in quite different ways. We must clearly distinguish between the development of the physical and the etheric bodies and that of the astral body and the ego. The outer signs of this dissimilar development express themselves, as you know from various indications I have given here and there, in the change of teeth and in the change that in the male appears as the change of voice at puberty and also proclaims itself clearly in the female, though in a different way. The essence of the phenomenon is the same as the voice change in the male, only in the female organism it appears in a more diffused form, so that it is not observable in merely one organ, as in the case of the male, but extends over the entire organism. You know that between the change of teeth and the change of voice, or puberty, lies the period of teaching with which we are principally concerned in the elementary schools. But the careful teacher and educator must also pay close attention to the years following puberty. Let us call to mind what the change of teeth signifies. Before the change of teeth, that is, between birth and the change of teeth, the physical and etheric bodies in the child's organism are strongly influenced by the nerve sense system operating from above downward. Up to about the seventh year, the physical body and the etheric body are most effectively influenced from the head. In the head are concentrated the forces that are particularly active in these years, that is, in the years when imitation plays such an important role. And what takes place in the formation of the remaining organism, trunk and limbs, is achieved through what rays down from the head to this other part, to the trunk and the limb organism, to the physical body and the etheric body. What radiates from the head into the physical and etheric bodies of the whole child, right into the tips of the fingers and toes, this radiating from the head into the whole child is soul activity, even though it emanates from the physical body. It is the same soul activity that is later active in the soul as intelligence and memory. Only later on, after the change of teeth, children begin to think in such a way that their memories become more conscious. The whole change that takes place in the child's soul life shows that certain soul forces, previously active in the organism, become active as soul forces after the seventh year. The whole period up to the change of teeth, while the child is growing, makes use of the same forces that after the seventh year appear as intellectual forces. Here you have an interplay between soul and body that is quite real. The soul emancipates itself in the seventh year and begins to function no longer in the body but independently. At this point, those forces that come newly into being in the body as soul forces begin to be active. And from the seventh year on, they are at work well into the next incarnation. Then whatever radiates upward from the body is thrust back, whereas the forces that shoot downward from the head are restrained. Thus, during the time the teeth are changing, the most severe battle is fought between the forces striving downward from above and those shooting upward from below. The change of teeth is the physical expression of this conflict between the two kinds of forces, those that later appear in the child as powers of reasoning and intellect, and those that need to be used particularly in drawing, painting, and writing. We employ upwelling forces when we develop writing out of drawing. For what these forces really strive for is to pass over into sculptural formation, drawing, and so forth. These are the sculptural forces that, ending with the change of teeth, have previously modeled the child's body. We work with them later, when the second dentition is completed, to lead the child to drawing, to painting, and so on. These are primarily the forces that were placed into the child by the spiritual world in which the child's soul lived before conception. At first they are active as bodily forces, informing the head, and then from the seventh year on they function as soul forces. Therefore, in the period following the seventh year, through authority in our teaching, we simply draw forth what had earlier been unconsciously active in the child as imitation. At that time, these forces had a strong, unconscious influence on the body. If later the child becomes a sculptor, a draftsperson, or an architect, but a real architect who works out of formative principles, it is because such a person has the predisposition for retaining in his or her organism, specifically in the head, a little more of the forces that radiate downward into the organism, so that later on these forces of childhood can still radiate downward. But if they are entirely used up, if with the change of teeth everything passes over into the soul, then we will have children without a talent for drawing, sculpture, or architecture, who could never become sculptors. This is the secret. These forces are related to what we have experienced between death and a new birth. The reverence that is needed to make education effective, something that can take on a religious quality, will arise if you, as a teacher, are conscious that when around the seventh year you call forth from the child's soul the forces that are used when a child learns to draw and to write, these actually come down from heaven. The child is the mediator, and you are actually working with forces sent down from the spiritual world. When this reverence for the divine spiritual permeates your teaching, it truly works miracles. And if you have reverence, if you have the feeling that by means of this connection with forces developed in the spiritual world before birth, a feeling that engenders a deep reverence, you will see that through such a feeling you can accomplish more than through any amount of intellectual theorizing about what should be done. Reverence will have an immeasurable formative influence upon the child. The teacher's feelings are certainly the most important tools of education. During the child's change of teeth, then, transference of spiritual forces is being enacted. Forces that move from the spiritual world through the child and into the physical world. Another process takes place in puberty, but it is prepared gradually through the whole cycle of years from the 7th to the 14th or 15th. During this time, something is stirring to life in those regions of our soul that are not yet illuminated by consciousness. Something is radiating continuously into us from the outer world. We are unconscious of it, for our own consciousness is only now being formed. What since birth has permeated the child from the outer world, what has cooperated in building up the body and has emerged into the child's formative forces, is now gradually emerging into consciousness. These are yet different forces. While the sculptural forces enter the head from within, these others now come from outside, forcing their way through the sculptural forces and descending into the organism. They cooperate in what takes place, beginning with the seventh year, in building up the child's body. I can only characterize these forces as those active in speech and in music. They are forces of a musical nature that we take up from the outer world, the world outside humankind, from our observation of nature and its processes, above all, from observation of nature's regularities and irregularities. For everything going on in nature is permeated by a hidden music, the earthly projection of the, in quotes, music of the spheres. Every plant, every animal actually incorporates a tone of the music of the spheres. This is also true of the human body. The music of the spheres still lives in the forms and structure of the body, but it no longer lives in human speech, expressing the soul nature. All of this the child absorbs unconsciously, and for this reason children are so highly musical. They are taking all of this up into their bodily organism. What children experience as formed movement, as linear and sculptural elements, comes from within, from the head. What children absorb as tone texture, as speech content, comes from outside. Somewhat later, around the 14th year, what is coming from outside works against the gradually developing spiritual element of music and speech coming from within. A process of pressing them together, of compacting, takes place in the girl's whole organism. In the boy, more in the region of the larynx, where it causes the change of voice. This process is brought about by an element from within, bearing more of the nature of will, that runs up against a similar will element coming from outside. This conflict finds expression in the change of voice and the other changes at puberty. It is a battle between inner and outer forces of music and speech. Up to the 7th year, the human being is permeated on the whole more by sculptural and less by musical forces. That is, less by the inspiring music and speech forces that enkindle the whole organism. But beginning with the 7th year, music and speech become particularly active in the etheric body. Then the ego and the astral body turn against this. An element of will battles from outside against a similar will element from within, and this becomes apparent at puberty. The difference that exists between male and female has another outer manifestation in the difference of vocal pitch. The voice levels of a man and woman coincide only in part. The voice of the woman reaches higher, that of a man descends deeper into the bass. This corresponds precisely to the structure of the rest of the organism, formed out of the struggle between these forces. All this shows that in our soul life we are concerned with something that at certain definite times also cooperates in the building up of the organism. All the abstract discussions you find in modern scientific books on psychology, all the talk about psychophysical parallelism, are testimony to the inability of our philosophers and psychologists to grasp the connection between the psychological and the physical. The psychological is certainly not connected with the physical in the manner set forth in the senseless theories thought out by the psychophysical parallelists. We should recognize the wholly concrete action of the psychological in the body and its reactions, one of which we will speak of shortly. Up to the 7th year, the sculptural element works together with the music and speech elements. Then there is a change, so that from the 7th year, the relation between music and speech on the one hand and the sculptural on the other is a different one. But through the whole period up to puberty, this cooperation takes place between the sculptural, which emanates from the head and has its seat there, and music and speech, which come from outside, using the head as a conduit, and spread themselves into the organism. From this we see that human language, particularly its musical element, cooperates in shaping the human being. First it forms us, then it stems itself, pausing at the larynx, so that it does not pass this entrance gate as it did before, For before, you see, it has been speech that changed our organs, even down into the bony system. And anyone who observes a human skeleton from a genuine psychophysical point of view, not with the absurd psychophysical thoughts of our contemporary philosophers and psychologists, and considers the differences between the male and the female skeleton, will see in the skeleton an embodied piece of music performed by the reciprocal action of the human organism and the outer world. Were we to play a sonata and preserve its structure through some spiritual process of crystallization, we would have, as it were, the principal forms, the scheme of arrangement of the human skeleton. And that will incidentally attest to the difference between human beings and animals. Whatever the animal absorbs of the music and speech element, very little of the speech, but very much of the musical, passes to the animal, because in a sense the animal lacks the human isolation that later leads to mutation. In the shape of an animal skeleton, we also have a musical imprint, but a composite of different animal skeletons, such as one finds, for instance, in a museum, is needed to provide a complete musical impression. An animal invariably manifests a one-sidedness in its structure. We ought to consider such things carefully. They will show us what feelings we should develop in forming our picture of the human being. Just as our reverence grows if we cultivate our connection and attunement with prenatal forces, we will acquire greater enthusiasm for teaching by immersing ourselves in other human forces. A Dionysian element irradiates, as it were, the music and speech instruction, while we have more of an Apollonian element in teaching sculpture, painting, and drawing. The instruction that has to do with music and speech we will impart with enthusiasm. The other we will give with reverence. The sculptural forces offer the stronger opposition. Hence they are arrested as early as the seventh year. The other forces, counteracting less vigorously, are arrested only in the 14th year. You must not take this to mean physical strength and weakness. I am referring to the counter-pressure that is exerted. Since the sculptural forces, being stronger, would overwhelm the human organism, the counter-pressure is greater. Therefore, they must be arrested earlier, whereas the musical forces are permitted by cosmic guidance to remain longer in the organism. The human being is permeated longer by the musical forces than by the sculptural. If you let this thought ripen within you and bring the requisite enthusiasm to bear, conscious that by developing an appreciation for speech and music precisely during the elementary school period, when the struggle we referred to is still raging and when you are still influencing the bodily nature, not just the soul nature, then you are preparing what will have an effect and be carried even beyond death. We are contributing essentially to this through everything we impart to the child in the way of music and speech during the elementary school period. And this should give us a certain enthusiasm, because we know that thereby we are working for the future. On the other hand, by working with sculptural forces, we are in touch with what already lay in the human being before birth, before conception, and this gives us reverence. We combine our own forces with those that reach into the future and realize that we are fructifying the germ of music and speech with something that will have its effect on these in the future after the physical has been cast off. Music itself reflects the music of the spheres in the air, only thus does it become physical. The air is in a sense the medium in which tones become physical, just as it is the air in the larynx that makes speech physical. It is the non-physical in the air, used in speech, and the non-physical in the air used in music, that unfold their true activity only after death. That is what brings about our enthusiasm for teaching, for we know that we are working into the future. I believe that in the future people will no longer talk to teachers about education as they usually do today, but rather in ideas and concepts that can be transformed into feelings. For nothing is more important than that we are able as teachers to develop the necessary reverence, the necessary enthusiasm, so that we can teach with reverence and enthusiasm. Reverence and enthusiasm, these are the two secret and fundamental forces that must permeate the teacher's soul with spirit. To help you understand all this better, I should like to mention that the musical element is at home principally in the astral body. After death, we still carry our astral body with us for a time. And as long as that is so, until we lay it aside completely, you are familiar with this from my book titled Theosophy, there still exists in us, after death, a kind of recollection. It is no more than a memory of earthly music. In this way, the music we receive during our life works on as a musical memory after death, until about the time the astral body is laid aside. Then, in the life after death, the earthly music is transformed into the music of the spheres, and it remains as such until some time before a new birth. This will be more comprehensible to you if you know that the music we take in here on earth plays a powerful role in shaping our soul organism after death, during the period of Kamaloka. This is the comforting feature of the Kamaloka time. And if we know this, we are essentially in a position to ease for people what the Roman Catholics call the fires of purgatory. Not, to be sure, by removing their contemplation of it, which they must have. They would remain imperfect if they could not observe the imperfect things they have done. But we introduce the possibility that human beings will be better formed in their next life if, during the time after death, when they still have their astral body, they can have many memories of musical experiences. This can be studied at a comparatively low stage of spiritual knowledge. You need only wake up in the night after having heard a concert, and you will be aware that you have experienced the whole concert again before waking. You even experience it much better when waking in the night after the concert. The experience is very accurate. The point is that music imprints itself upon the astral body. It remains there. It still resonates. It remains for about 30 years after death. Music continues to resonate much longer than speech. We lose the latter comparatively quickly after death, and only its spiritual extract remains. What is musical is preserved as long as the astral body. The essence of speech can be a great gift to us after death, especially if we have often absorbed it in the form I now frequently describe as the art of recitation. When I describe the latter in this way, I naturally have every reason to point out that these things cannot be rightly understood without keeping in view the peculiar course the astral body takes after death. Matters must then be described somewhat as I have done in my lectures on Eurythmy. Footnote, Rudolf Steiner, title and introduction to Eurythmy, Anthroposophic Press, New York, 1984. End of footnote. Here, you see, we must talk to people in more or less primitive language, and it is really true that, seen from the point of view beyond the threshold, everyone is actually primitive. Only beyond the threshold are they real human beings. And we can only work ourselves out of this primitive state by working our way into spiritual reality. This is also the reason for the constantly increasing and primitive fury against the endeavors of anthroposophy. Now, I would like to point out something that should have our particular attention in the art of education, something that can be useful there, namely that a certain characteristic is to be noted in what I described as the first conflict in the child, whose outer expression is the change of teeth, and in the later struggle, whose equivalent is the change of voice. Everything that descends from the head until the seventh year, appears as an attack on what is coming to the child from within in the nature of upbuilding forces. And everything that works outward, from within upward to the head, countering the stream emanating from the head, is like a defense opposed to the downward stream, which could be considered an attack, as an attack. It is similar in the case of music, but here what comes from within appears as an attack, and what descends from above through the head organism appears as the defense. If we did not have music, frightful forces would actually rise up in us. I am completely convinced that up to the 16th or 17th century, traditions deriving from the ancient mysteries were active, and that even then people still wrote and spoke under the influence of this after-effect of the mysteries. They no longer knew, to be sure, the whole meaning of this effect, but in much that still appears in comparatively recent times, we simply have remnants of the old mystery wisdom. Hence I have always been deeply impressed by the words of Shakespeare, quote, "The man that hath no music in himself is fit for treasons, stratagems, and spoils. Let no such man be trusted." Close quote. Footnote from The Merchant of Venice, Act 5, Scene 1. End of footnote. In the old mystery schools, the pupils were told that what acts as an attack from within us, it must be continually warded off. What is damned back for the sake of human nature is, quote, "treasons, stratagems, and spoils," close quote, and that the music that is active in us is what counteracts it. Music is our defense against the luciferic forces rising up out of the inner human being, disloyalty, murder, and deceit. We all have disloyalty, murder, and deceit within us, and it is not without reason that the world contains what comes to us from music and speech, quite aside from the pleasure it affords. Its purpose is to make people into human beings. One must, of course, keep in mind that the old mystery teachers expressed themselves somewhat differently. They expressed things more concretely. They would not have said, quote, "treasons, stratagems, and spoils," close quote, it is already toned down in Shakespeare, but would have said something like, quote, "serpent, wolf, and fox," close quote. The serpent, the wolf, and the fox are warded off from the inner nature of the human being through music. The old mystery teachers would always have used animal forms to depict what rises up within us, but must then be transformed into what is human. So it is that we can achieve the right enthusiasm when we see the treacherous serpent rising out of the child and combat it with music and speech instruction. And in the same way, contend with the murderous wolf and the tricky fox or cat. That is what can then permeate us with true intelligent enthusiasm, not the burning luciferic sort that alone is acknowledged today. In recognizing the interplay between attack and defense, we must remember that defense occurs in us on two levels. The first is within ourselves, where a warding off appears in the change of teeth in the seventh year. The second is what we have received from music and speech, when this wards off what tends to rise up within us. Both battlefields are within the human being. What comes from music and speech is more toward the periphery, toward the outer world, and the sculptural tends more toward the inner world. But there is still a third battlefield, and that lies on the boundary between the etheric body and the outer world. The etheric body is always larger than the physical body, reaching out beyond it in all directions, and here too is a battlefield. Here the battle is fought more consciously, whereas the other two proceed more in the subconscious. This third and more conscious battle reveals itself when the other battles, the exchange between the human being and the sculptural on the one hand, and what pertains to speech and music on the other hand, work themselves out and become a part of the etheric body. Taking hold of the astral body, this new force then moves more toward the periphery or outer boundary. From this originates everything that shoots through our fingers when we draw, paint, and so on. Painting is an art, therefore, that works more in our environment. The draftsperson, the sculptor, must work more out of inner faculties, the musician more out of devotion to the world. What presents itself in painting and drawing, to which we lead the children when we have them draw forms and lines, is the battle that takes place wholly on the surface. It is fought principally between two forces, one working inward from outside, the other working outward from within. The force working outward from within actually tends to constantly spread a person out, tends to continue the formation of the human being, not violently, but in a delicate way. This force, I must express it more drastically than it really is, but in this exaggeration you will see what I mean. This force, working outward from within, tends to make our eyes bulge out, wants to give us a goiter, to make our nose puff out and to make the ears bigger. Everything tends to swell outward. Another force is present, however, when we absorb from the outer world that wards off this swelling. And even if we only draw a line, draw something, this is an effort to divert, through this force working in from the outer world, that inner force which is trying to deform us. It is a complicated reflex action, then, that we execute in painting and drawing and graphic activity. In drawing or in having the canvas before us, a feeling is actually glimmering in our consciousness that we are rebuffing something that is out there, that in the forms and lines we are setting up thick walls or barbed wire. In drawing we really have such barbed wire, by means of which we quickly catch something swelling that tends to destroy us from within, preventing its action from becoming too strong. Therefore drawing instruction works best if it is based on a study of the human being. If you study the motions the hand tends to make, if, say, in eurythmy classes, you have the children hold the motions, the gestures they want to carry out, then you have arrested the motion, the line that tends to destroy, and it does not act destructively. So when you begin to have the children draw eurythmic forms, and then see that drawing and also writing are formed out of the will that lives in gesture, you have something that human nature really wants, something linked with its being and becoming. In connection with eurythmy, we should know that in our etheric body, we constantly have the tendency to do eurythmy. It is something the etheric body simply does of its own accord, for eurythmy is nothing but motions gleaned from what the etheric body tends to do of itself. It is really the etheric body that makes these motions, and it is only prevented from doing so when we cause the physical body to carry them out. When we allow them to be made by the physical body, these movements are checked in the etheric body, but react upon us, this time with a health-giving effect. These are things that affect the human being, both in a curative, therapeutic, and an educational way. They will be understood only when we know that whatever is trying to manifest itself in the etheric organization must be stopped at the periphery by the movements of the physical body. In the case of eurythmy, an element more connected with the will is stopped. In drawing and painting, it is an element more closely allied with the intellect. Fundamentally, both are two poles of the same thing. If we feel our way into this process and incorporate it into our sensitive capacity as teachers, we will arrive at the third feeling we need, which should permeate us through all our work in the elementary school. When children come into the world, they are exposed to things that we must protect them from through our teaching. Otherwise, they would flow too actively into the world. A person always has the tendency to become weak and stunted in soul, to make rachitic limbs, to become a gnome. And in teaching and educating someone, we work at forming an individual. We sense this formative activity best if we observe the child making a drawing and we smooth it out a bit so that the result is not only what the child wants and not exactly what we want either, but the result of both. If I can do this, improve what the child scribbles with his or her fingers, in merging my feelings with the child, the best results will come of it. And if I transform all this into a feeling and let it permeate me, it will be the feeling that I must protect the child from being absorbed too strongly by the outer world. We must see that the children grow slowly into the outer world and not let them do it too rapidly. We constantly hold a protecting hand over the child. This is the third feeling we teachers must cherish. Reverence, enthusiasm, and a sense of guardianship. These three are actually the panacea, the magic remedy, in the soul of the educator and teacher. And if one wished to represent externally, artistically, something like an embodiment of art and education in an harmonious group, one would have to create it like this: reverence for what precedes the child's existence before birth, enthusiastic anticipation of what follows it after death, protective gesture for what the child experiences during life. Footnote: Rudolf Steiner accompanied each of these phrases with a gesture. The following description is attributed to Caroline von Heidebrandt. The gesture for reverence: hands folded in prayer. In the stenographic record, two hands inclined upward with the fingertips toward each other. The gesture for enthusiasm: hands outstretched, pointing. The protective feeling: the right arm encircling, as in the eurythmy gesture for B. End of footnote. In this formulation, the outward manifestation of the teacher's nature also comes to expression. In speaking of such matters, drawn from the intimacies of world mysteries, we sense how unsatisfactory it must always be to use conventional language. If one must say such things in ordinary language, one always has the feeling that a corollary or supplement is needed. What is spoken more abstractly always wants to pass over into the artistic. That is why I wanted to make this final point. We must learn to carry within us something that everyone in the future will feel. The possession of science alone makes the human being into what resembles a dwarf in soul and spirit. A scientist pure and simple will not have the impulse, not even in the forming of his or her thoughts, to transform the scientific into the artistic. But only through the artistic do we grasp the world. Goethe's words will always be true, quote, "He to whom nature begins to reveal her manifest secrets feels an irresistible longing for her most worthy interpreter, art." Close quote. As educators, we should be able to perceive that as far as you are only a scientist, you might as well be an ignoramus. Not until you have transformed your organism of soul, spirit, and body, when your knowledge assumes an artistic form, will you become a human being. Our future development, and in this teachers will have to play their part, will lead from science to artistic understanding, from a deformed being to the attainment of full humanity. The end of Lecture 2.